Today we have Paul Jackson from Animal House Fitness. Paul, thank you for being here.
Yeah, Chad. Thanks for having me, man.
All right. So what is Animal House Fitness?
So Animal House Fitness is a company we started around our main product that we invented called Monkey Feet. And it lets you lift kind of any standard dumbbell with your feet. So it kind of looks like a snowboard binding, and it'll go around any dumbbell. It actually goes around like kettlebells, barbells. It's really just like a clamp, and then they can go around any handle, and then you put your foot in it, and then you can do all kinds of exercises. So anything like hamstring curls are probably the most popular, but you can do, you know, high knee raises for hip flexors. You can do leg extensions. You can do weighted pull-ups, a lot of ab work stuff. So yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah, and so here's the product. If everybody's looking for it, it really does look like a snowboard binding, and then the dumbbell goes right in here. And it's what's interesting about this is that it is like it's kind of like your bicep. So it gives your feet the ability to do what your hands can do around a barbell or a dumbbell. And so you can do curls and you can do tricep extensions and things like that. So it just basically gives your, so that's why it's great that it's Monkey Feet, is because it's a perfect name because it does give your feet the ability to grab onto something in order to do the same workout, functionality as dumbbells do with your arms.
Okay. Yeah, so it's nuts. Sorry. I feel like the craziest piece I get when explaining it is people start to understand it, and then you go like, oh, like what things can you do with it? And it's like, what can you do with your hands with dumbbells? It's like, it's so endless that kind of unlocks people to where it's kind of the same for your lower body. But anyways.
Yeah. And so how long have you been selling this product?
We're coming up on 4 years this year. And so like 3.5 years now.
Are you doing right now?
Right now we're doing like upper 7 figures.
And how many people run the business?
So it's me, my co-founder, one full-time employee, one part-time employee, and then just like a bunch of agencies. So pretty lean.
Describe it like the agency. So like kind of give us a rundown of, you know, is it like email marketing? Is it graphic designers?
Yeah, for sure. And all of these are like agencies that we have on like monthly retainer, to where we have, email, we have Google ads, we have, influencer seeding and Facebook ads. That's one. We have like a bookkeeping agency. We have a 3PL. We have customer service. So kind of, I think we have like 6 or 7, but all that stuff is kind of outsourced to a certain extent, still high touch on it, but outsourced. And then the jobs we have in-house, we really see as like our core competencies.
Okay. And the jobs in-house are?
So it's mainly breaks down to like product design, and then marketing, like organic marketing stuff. I mean, we're like mainly e-commerce, so marketing is like the biggest one besides all the product design stuff and having a bit of a finger on the pulse in the fitness industry.
Okay, so really it's just a couple of people and a bunch of agencies. I assume when you started the business, you and your co-founder were doing all those jobs, and slowly you started dripping out these things one by one to other people. Can you give me like a little bit of a, when you were going through that process, you know, what was the first agency you hired? What was the second, like, what was the first task you offloaded? What was the next task, and how did that evolve?
Yeah, it's a great, great question. Cause it's a piece of, at least how we think about it, is you kind of start doing everything, as you were saying, and then you have a mix of either what you lose competency in or what you become, like what's taking all your time that shouldn't be. It's a mix of those two things, to where they start like offloading those to agencies. For instance, one of the first ones was customer service, to where we're, instead of spending time like figuring out our customer and trying to expand as much as we can and working on marketing, we're spending time on like customer service tickets. And so that's when we outsourced to an agency there. On the contrary, we got to a point to where we didn't know, I don't want to say we didn't know our financials as well as we could, but we were doing our books when we like shouldn't have. And then that's when we outsourced to a bookkeeping agency. But the very first one we hired was actually a guy I met in college very, very briefly. And we talked about Facebook ads a bit. And I remember it was like a weekend And, you know, we kind of sold the first friends and family round and, or like of products and stuff. Like my mom bought the first ones and I was like, yeah, I sold some. Oh, it's just my mom. I was like, oh, we sold another one. It's like, oh, it's just my co-founder's mom. But like after the first week of where we had some organic spool and everything going, I hit up my buddy and I was like, hey, tell me about this Facebook ads thing. You know, what is like, how do I get going? And he helped me get it all going. And we launched on there, fast forward, you know, a month or two. He completely took it over in his agency and we started seeding influencers. And that's what really helped rocket us to like, you know, above seven figures, well into the mid seven figures in the first year, just through that stuff alone. So, yeah, a mix of everything. But again, it's like the stuff that we weren't doing in-house well is where we kind of look to outsource.
Yeah. So, I mean, my company Better Legal is very, very similar. It was just in-house, you know, the co-founders. And then it was, I think, customer experience or Google Ads. It was one or the other. And then the other one was second. And then, you know, books and then things like that. So yeah, I think probably customer service and ads are probably the first things that are necessary for that. So it's interesting to hear that. But also, yeah, my company's also run mainly by contractors. Yours is agencies. Mine is contractors. I like to go find the individual person doing the work and find someone that I trust and that it is autonomous and that I can kind of like work with when I need to, but can be hands off most of the other time. Okay. So well, give me a little background on the other products that you sell, because it's not just Monkey Feet. So you've got other things that you sell. I know they're not as popular as the original product. And I think that just goes, every business is similar to that, right? Like look at Google, look at how much money Google spends into trying to find something that's going to be as profitable or big as search. And they just have never been able to replicate it. So I think that's just a standard problem that businesses have. But what are the other products that you sell?
Yeah, totally. And it's a piece that's been, I don't know if frustrating is the right word, but not frustrating to where we, you know, we launched this one product and saw a bunch of success with it. It's like, cool, let's, and originally the next two products were around really customer service inquiries, people going like, oh, my strap's not long enough. I need a longer strap. So we made an XL strap kit. And the next one was, okay, I want to use this, but what dumbbells do I use? I don't have dumbbells yet. And so we kind of made a little pack of dumbbells that you could buy. We named it the banana pack. We thought we were clever there. But it was really off the back of customer service inquiries there. And that helped reduce those customer service inquiries and it lifted revenue like a little bit. Didn't do a ton. And then after that, when we were looking at new products, we kind of had like kind of like a threefold approach of what we wanted to like try and test out. One was digital products, because we're like, how do we get some of that sweet LTV? So it's like, how can we dabble in that and see if there's something there? The second one is basically non-patented, more white label products. And this was like our, we have a couple of different types of resistance bands and then foam rollers. And then we picked those specifically because you can use all those with Monkey Feet. So they kind of work together well. And then the third piece was another patented, you know, innovative product. And fast forward a bit, we've launched two out of the three of those categories. And the third one we're about to launch next month, the patented one obviously takes the longest. And yeah, the other two have, again, moved the needle a little bit, but haven't what I call like fully reinvented the business and like done a big step function there. So it's interesting to look back on and see what's working and what's, you know, not working as well, but that's where we currently are now.
So you have this kind of theme of naming your products after animal stuff, because the first product was Monkey Feet. Did Animal House Fitness come first and then Monkey Feet, or did Monkey Feet come first and then Animal House Fitness came second, like from the name, and then the other products were just kind of thematically appropriate?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of this is around just having a little bit of fun with the business and all that kind of stuff. I think if we take stuff too seriously, you lose a little bit of the fun here. But Monkey Feet came first when we were trying to name that product. Actually, he's our first employee now. I thought he named it, but he's like he was saying that he thinks I named it. I think he named it, but he was joking around. He's like, it's like a monkey's foot. You can grab something. I was like, oh, that would be a great name. And then once we had that Animal House, we knew we wanted to make a brand above just the product, just so we're not just locked into having this one product and that being it. We had, you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, big dreams when we started this, and we were like, oh, we're going to be the next biggest fitness company ever, so we wanted to have a brand name, and so that's when we kind of were starting to look for something there, and Animal House kind of came off it, a little bit of a tribute to the old comedy movie, and after that, we wanted to, give like the animal theme name, and, you know, that goes back a little bit, not to get, you know, too corny into this stuff, but we have like a very like upcycle, environmentally friendly, you know, core values for us personally, me and my co-founder, and that's kind of a piece of it, and we wanted to have we had a goal to start giving some to environmental protection for charity by next year. It's coming up quick, but that's kind of always been a part of it, so it seemed to roll up nicely, and then we were just having too much fun with the names after that.
All right, so let's go back and go through your entire entrepreneurial journey. So the first thing that you did, and I don't know how old you were, but you were selling lemonade, like classic entrepreneurial start. Why don't you tell me how that started?
Yeah, I hate giving a little bit of a vanilla answer here, but I got a little bit of chocolate chip in there. But I think I was around, I want to say like 10, 12 years old, but we grew up next to like the community trail. And so I could easily go out and sell lemonade on the trail. But the thing I noticed is if I'd sell lemonade for like $4, I would get, you know, I'd get some people to buy it. And then every once in a while, you know, probably some rich dude would come around and give me like a $20 tip. And I was like, whoa, I'm making most of the money in the tips. Like, this is sweet. And then I also, my mom was a runner, and I was like, people sometimes ask for water, and I feel like a lot of people when they're running and stuff, they didn't really want lemonade, like sugary drink. They just kind of wanted some water. So what I tested out one time is just giving out free water. What I noticed is like, you know, free water, so a lot of people are down to take it, and then they feel compelled to tip. And when they tip more than like the $4. So started making more money, and I think I wrote here lower cogs, more tips. And so I didn't know what cogs were, cost of goods sold were at the time, but it was a funny concept to where it was like, you know, it cost me less to make this lemonade and I was making more and it was free. And it even had like that customer sentiment, like I was giving them something for free, which had a cool feel. But yeah, I think that was the first little business spice I had in my life.
Okay. And so then you moved to custom painted brake levers.
Yeah. Yeah, this is when I was, I think I was around like 15, 16, but this is probably the next little piece of like my product design life kind of coming in, to where I just loved customizing like everything I had, whether it was like my bicycle or later on like my cars and like everything like that. I just wanted to make like custom special. I think I just wanted to feel special, man. but the main thing I started doing was brake levers, to where I would, you know, shave them down and, you know, grind and Dremel and drill holes in them and stuff so that they were like ergonomic. And then I'd paint them cool. So ones you have up right here, are my like American flag ones I made. And then, you know, I had people asking about them and asking to buy them. So I started selling them to all my friends and anyone who kind of wanted them. I probably sold like 20 of them or something like that. Not a ton, but they took a long time to make. So yeah, that was
so what is the paint? Is this just spray paint? And then like, are these stencils, or how did you get this to look so like so phenomenal?
Thanks, man. It's all rattle can spray paint, and you know, the way you do it is you spray it all white and then you'll tape off half of it, and then you'll use tape to make the stripes on one side and you'll spray it red, and then once it dries you'll do the opposite on the other side. For the stars, they were like the gold star stickers that you'd get in like kindergarten when you did something good. And so you just use those kind of as stencils and then a clear coat the rest of it at the end. And then you could like cook it in the oven a bit to get it to all tall look dial.
And so you didn't do this for that long. You said you made about 20 of these. Is there a reason why you stopped? Was it not making any money, or it was just for fun at first? Or
I think it was just for fun, and I probably just ran out of friends, honestly. Friends with bikes.
Your TAM was too low.
Yeah, exactly. My total addressable homies was too low. But yeah, I think I didn't even think about it as like a business yet. It was just like, oh, you know, someone's giving me, you know, $20 to make them a lever. Like, sure. So that was just kind of like the start there.
How old were you at this time?
I think I was around 15, maybe 14 or 15.
And then you went to, and what I'm noticing from just your entire experience is that you are very, very kind of like widget based entrepreneur, like not software, nothing like that. Like these are physical products and you are doing like industrial design or engineering. So you went and worked at your uncle's engineering firm for a few years. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So this ended up being my kind of like summer job for like 4 or 5 years, but, you know, all the way up until high school. And I think I came back even my first year of college and did this, but you know, it's pretty funny. I grew up in a family of like cops and firefighters, everyone. And then one uncle that married in was an engineer, and you know, I kind of had the tinker mentality, and it was like, oh, you need to go talk to Dave. And you know, he has an engineering firm. So I ended up, you know, we got close, and then I ended up working for him every summer. And, you know, it was cool. Super small business is probably like 20, 25 people, but in-house they did everything from designing these fiber optic illuminators, these little lights, like dental lights, everything from the design to, you know, the assembly to packaging them all in-house. So when I started there, initially I was like sweeping floors and taping boxes, working, shipping and receiving. And then by the end of that, I was doing more like part assembly stuff and then a little bit of design by the end. So it was kind of cool to wear a lot of hats, as they say. But like you don't usually get to see, especially at a young age, see the like end to end of a business. You know, I feel like especially when people intern at big companies, like in college or something, they kind of see like one super, super magnified in piece of a business and try to make an assessment of what they think about that role. And so it's cool to get a bit of a higher level piece of it.
It's really interesting you say that. Cause when I was young, I was like intern guy. I interned at so many different companies doing all kinds of different things. And I agree with you, the smaller companies, you just absorbed a lot more random knowledge. What were things you really took out of that you might still use today?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's so important. I think interning is huge. Like I wish I did more of it. I don't want to get too down into like the school system chat too much, but like I think kids should be interning, you know, as early as like middle school just to get exposure to different stuff. Like it's kind of wild. We expect kids to have this idea of like what a lawyer and what a dentist does, and they've only ever seen it for like when they go to the dentist and hopefully not when they go to the lawyers, to a law office. But one of the main things I took away was just the pieces that I liked, and I guess more the pieces I didn't like. A big part was like, I don't want to sweep floors for the rest of my life for sure. And then, you know, the assembly line's tough, and you know, it's kind of even like the hierarchy of it. But one of the big things that I learned first there that I start learning over and over is when working on the assembly line stuff, you'd see when parts wouldn't go together and why things would stop working and where you'd get like issues with pieces, and making sure that loop gets closed with the designers and the people that are like designing the parts and stuff. So it's like, you know, design for manufacturing is like a big piece of engineering that I'd later learn, but I had an early intuition is the wrong word, but early exposure to it in a place like that.
I have a question that is a little off topic, and let me know if we should talk about this later in the episode. But I'm noticing that manufacturing is kind of coming back to the States. You know, pre-COVID, everything, it was basically like you built a prototype here, maybe you 3D printed it, just to see how it worked, and then you sent it off to have molds made in China, and then it would, like, you know, be cargo shipped over here. And I feel like there's a lot more stuff being built here and a lot more infrastructure, and just, or the technology is now better to where you don't need the hand finishing or whatever. And so you can kind of do it with more robotics. Like, is that accurate? Is that inaccurate?
I think the trend is slowly coming this way. It's hard because I think it's still really far off. Mm. And I think that for people that aren't as much in the weeds with this type of stuff, the thing to remember is there are two huge constraints when you talk about getting something from China, and, well, more than two, but there's two main ones. And one is, like, just the language barrier, how far away it is, the different time zones, all that piece. Communication is so much harder. And then the cash flow constraint in, like, as a whole, which really what that means is when you order from China and you put something on a ship to come over here, it's going to be at least 6 weeks, usually around 2 months after once they put it on a container and then it gets into your 3PL or into your warehouse. And the idea behind that is, let's say you spend $100,000 on a container. That means you have that $100,000 tied up in that for 2 months or more, to where, let's say you made it next to your warehouse. Now you can make it, like, there is no transit time. So you have so much less money tied up in such a less amount of time that it's so much easier on cash flow. And that, what cash flow really means there is, like, inventory forecasting, towards, instead of me needing to know what my sales are going to be like in 3-4 months, I really only need to know in, like, 2 to 4 weeks, because I can change the amount I order so quickly. So why I bring that up is, even despite all of that, it still makes more sense for people to be in China for the most part right now, which is crazy. So it's like, stuff has to get quite a bit worse for that to, I guess, stop making sense. And that's when, like, Trump starts talking about 60% tariffs and stuff like this is where it could push it. But that's more just, like, just China. And as much as I'd love to see stuff come back to the US, I think places like Mexico, where we have free trade agreements, they're on the same time zone as us. You know, English is a lot closer to Spanish and, you know, transit is just quicker and easier. So, like, I've seen Mexico blow up quite a bit, and it's something we're looking into lightly, but, yeah, I think the trend's starting, but I think it's going to be a while.
Okay. So after your uncle's engineering firm, you moved to a clothing company. You were still, you know, basically right out of high school, maybe early college. It's called the Stoke Company. What was that about?
Yeah, this is my baby. This is as much as I have, like, the, you know, the product design side of me, this is, like, the branding, fun, creative side, that I love. And we still work on this today, but basically what this was is a college product, project, to where, not, like, within my classes, but me and I had a bunch of buddies. We were all in different action sports. We were all trying to, like, go pro at something, and we could all still hang out and have that same vibe of trying to do all this. Like, we had that common piece, and that's where we landed on the name Stoked. It's like, we had that common Stoke. And it's something that we were like, oh, we should start something around this. And so I started making t-shirts, and it kind of snowballed a bit from there, but, you know, it's been, that was early college. So, you know, that's been, geez, like 10 years, 12 years working on this. But it's been very much on the side. It's never made, like, a ton of money. Honestly, have never put nowhere near to full-time focus on it, but it's been a fun side project and a bit of, like, creative expression, especially locally. We've like put on a few local jump jams and, you know, help teach kids to ride up in Woodward and stuff. So it's been fun.
So have you been working on this for, like you said, almost a decade? How many hours would you say you put into it, maybe a week or a month, early on, versus now?
So it fluctuated a lot, because I think this is when I first started being like, oh, I think this is probably when I learned entrepreneur is a word. And I was like, oh, I think this is something I might be. And so I started getting into this and talking to people. So at the beginning, it was a lot more. I would say maybe like 4, 5, 6 hours a week. And then throughout my life, it's fluctuated a bit. You know, right now, it's probably 2 hours a month. It's really not much. But I do remember specifically right before starting Animal House and starting that project, I was trying to go all in on Stoked. And we were ramping up, doing a bunch more designs, where I was getting a team together more. So it's fluctuated. It's always kind of been on the back burner a bit, but it's always kind of been there.
What kind of revenue does that do?
I think the biggest year we did was like 10 grand in a year. Like, it's been very small. We've done no paid ads, no anything like that. It's all, and this is very much starting to just like learn this space. It's very much my hobby, like passion project. It's not a moneymaker, but
are there things that carried over from Stoked to Animal House Fitness that, like, you know, were just things that you learned from Stoked that once you started Animal House Fitness, it was just like, oh, I know how to do this.
Yeah, totally. I mean, at very basic levels, just starting a company, like what do I incorporate as, like, all those basic business things. Like, I had already gotten one rep through that. You know, a lot of the social, we're decent. I think we have like 7,000 followers on Instagram and we barely put any effort into it, but it's like, that was one of the things that me and the guy that works on this with me, so he's like my childhood best friend who now works on this with me the most, but he's also our first hire that I mentioned earlier for Animal House, who's our head of marketing, to where we kind of got first big reps on this, trying to do Instagram and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of little things, and working with influencers and stuff, much more on the like non-paid side, like, hey man, we love your stuff, you want a t-shirt? So yes, it's a good example of just trying to get reps and failing it. I even call it failing, like in quotes, but like just trying different stuff, whether it's the main thing or not early on, just to get some exposure to it. So that when you see it, the time that matters, you actually kind of know what things are. Like, you know what an LLC is versus the first time on this, where I don't. So
I like that terminology. I like the idea of getting your reps in versus failing or failures. I think too often entrepreneurs think that, you know, they see someone like Mark Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos, and those are easy entrepreneurs to look up to because they're the ones that get talked about the most, and or Elon, right? And it's like, okay, well, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, started Facebook right out of college. Jeff Bezos basically was working at a firm and then said, I'm going to start Amazon, and then did. And Elon, you know, basically had a whole string of serial successes. I'm not sure any were really failures. You think he sold them all for, so people look at those and think like, I'm going to be the next, you know, mega billionaire. And that's just, you're just not going to be that person. Statistically, there are a handful in a generation. We just have more than our fair share in this generation and they get the most press, but more than likely you're going to be someone that makes $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 a year. You know, and I think that's doable. I think as we progress and more people are starting to realize that corporations don't really care about them, and, you know, if they can replace people with AI, they will. And so we're living in an era right now where more people need to start businesses and we need to have more small giants. And the only way that you can do that is by getting your reps in. And by trying a business, see if it works. And if it doesn't, move on to the next, take your learnings from the last one and pour them into the new one, and then rinse and repeat. And then just do that over and over.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I don't know, as someone that's, if you're listening to this and you're, you know, younger and you're aspiring to be entrepreneurial, you think you have that bug, that thing that makes you want to make stuff. I think it's a lot more comforting and less pressure inducing instead of going, oh, you need to get it right, knock it out of the park on the first time. Like, that's tons of pressure. And, you know, that's probably not going to be the right environment to make you succeed. what's really comforting to me is I think that if you are that kind of person and you just start taking shots on goal and getting reps in and trying stuff, if you do that for the next 20 years, like something's going to work. Mm-hmm. Like you are going to get somewhere. Even if you try 100 different things, like 99th might not work, like the 100th, at some point you are going to get something that works and you're going to learn a lot on the way. And to me, that's all that really matters. Like you just want to make something work. So I don't know. It's a lot more comforting and kind of alleviates a little bit of the pressure, at least in my mind.
I think there's a lot more luck in success than people give credit for. But it's not just the luck. It's the luck and the preparation to take advantage of the opportunity when it's there. Have you gotten your reps in? Have you made these attempts and learned from them? And then the right opportunity hits at the right time, then you're able to take advantage of it. And that's where the success comes from. But, you know, when we're kids, we're taught, you know, when you're learning how to walk and you fall, you know, every single time until you get it right. And then you're stumbling and then you're kind of slowly getting it right. Your parents aren't like, you're an idiot, like walk right. You know, society's not like you're stupid, you know, do it right the first time.
Yeah.
It's like, you're doing better. But then somehow something flips into adulthood where it's this feeling of failure and you need to be able to do it right the first time or you're just not cut out for it. And I think so with luck and opportunity, you also need that grit to be able to say like, okay, if this is the right opportunity, I need to have the grit. Just like you said earlier, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed going into it, not realizing how difficult it was going to be. Having the grit to be able to like withstand the roller coaster of entrepreneurship, because there are a bunch of highs and there are a bunch of lows, and you need to be able to kind of like ride that middle line and like not get too high. Like the higher you go, it's like your Icarus flying towards the sun. And then when it's low, you get really low. And so you kind of need to understand to ride that middle line. And when things are great, you need to kind of like temper your excitement. When things are bad, you need to temper your, depression, I guess.
Yeah, totally. Riding that even keeledness is definitely important, easier said than done.
Okay. So now we're making barbecue grills into truck tailgates. This, I don't understand why it didn't work. And this is another example. This is like, maybe it was just the wrong idea at the wrong time or the wrong geographic location. But tell us about these things. Cause I think if I were to show 10 friends, you'd have 7 orders.
Yeah. So you look this thing up, right? It's pretty sick, huh?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. We're about to show it here. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is funny. I can't fully remember where it started, where the idea started, but you know, I think I went to UCLA, pretty big, football culture there, not like the South, but you know, for California. And we go tailgate on this beautiful, at the Rose Bowl, beautiful grass golf course. And you weren't allowed to have, I think it was something about barbecues on the ground or something, because it was a golf course. So we'd always have it on the tailgate. And, you know, my product design brain initially goes like, why don't you just put it like in the tailgate? Wouldn't that be cool? Blah, blah, blah. So I ended up making one version that was kind of janky, but it worked, and it's all propane and everything. So I would just have a propane tank, feeding it into, so for those listening, it's flush in the tailgate of a truck. And so it's basically like if you pulled your tailgate down and you put a burger patty on the tailgate, that's kind of what it looks like, except that is a barbecue and the barbecue is always there. So you could kind of, as long as you had a propane tank, you can kind of barbecue wherever, which ended up being pretty cool for, you know, a bunch of guys in college and stuff. But I made two versions. One was kind of janky. And then the second one, because everyone liked the first, I would bring it to tailgates and people would go nuts over it. Especially when people have a couple of beers in them. They're like, whoa, what is this thing, man? And
collecting deposits at the tailgate.
A few guys like business cards, because they're like, I want to do something. I don't even remember what it was for, but it was cool. And I was like, well, I might be onto something. We joined the entrepreneur club at UCLA, and me and a couple of people tried to make this more of a business. So I designed, like, actually legit catted up one like it would be a production thing. And, you know, not to get too deep in this, but it was, I guess what I'll say is it was a very complex business in the sense of, in order to get people to, there's kind of two roads you can go down with this. It's like, you need to get people to custom install these and have all the training behind it and have different literature around all the different types of trucks, truck tailgates and everything for it to fit. That was a big lift. And then the other side is you make truck tailgates that are just plug and play, but now you have to make every truck tailgate and every color and all that kind of stuff. So it got complicated really quick. And it was one of those things that we kind of just got bogged down and overwhelmed, and we're like, oh, okay, maybe this isn't it. And so we kind of abandoned it, but it's always one night when I remember it, I come back to it and I was like, that thing is pretty cool.
I wonder if it would make more sense to sell directly to like the customized or the rebuilder community. So like my wife's grandma has a, she lives in Kerrville, and there is like, I think they do Wagoneers, but it's like Wagoneer World or Wagoneer Central. And they basically go buy old, I think it's Wagoneers. It might be something else, but, they go buy these old Wagoneers and then just restore them, to their, like their original glory. And so maybe the business is not to sell direct to consumer, but to those. And then they just say, you know, hey, this is an add-on, and then you can focus on one at a time. But I think it's a brilliant idea. My question regarding this is, and this kind of flows through with the manufacturing thing we talked about, is creating a prototype, like, you know, obviously if you're going to order a certain amount and you need a lot of product, you have to order from China, as you said, but what does the prototyping stage look like? Like, can you sell your first 10 products by making them locally? And are they just worse, or can you make really good prototypes that you can sell? And then that gives you the kind of confidence knowing that you've got enough of demand and the product is good enough to then go and offshore?
Yeah, great question. And it's like any good answer, it's like, it depends scenario. Something like this, if someone came up to me with this idea and they really want to do it, I would say make your first ones like by hand and get customers and iterate, because you can learn so much from the manufacturing process and customer feedback. And they're so big and more expensive that you can get more one-off stuff. The hard part for something like Monkey Feed, our product, is you need tooling cost. And so to cut all of the tools for the plastic parts, the injection molded parts, that's like a big lump sum there. So you can do 3D printed ones first, and maybe that is the right way to like start really slow. But I think what helps a bit more is, instead of going into like selling your first ones like that, just try to get customer feedback as much as you can, to where, and that's a whole nother like rabbit hole. But
how do you get customer feedback if you don't have a product? It's kind of like a chicken and the egg problem, where like you don't have a product, because, you know, are you going to make the product and then have it sent, you know, 2 months long from China, and then get it in customers' hands, have them give you feedback? It sounds like a really slow process. So like, can you use modern 3D printing technology? And it's probably not by buying the printer. You're probably, I've always kind of wondered why like Kinko's FedEx never really got into this business, where they've got installations around every major city. Why don't they have kind of a 3D printing, like service?
Yeah,
where it's like, okay, we're doing manufacturing locally, and we need to make, you know, 20 items or 50 items, so you can like use them and get them in people's hands, so you can iterate faster, so when you are ready to make that big purchase, you can, you know, do it confidently overseas.
Yeah, you're spot on there, to where I guess just the point of when you sell to people, it's like whether that should be a prototype or not can kind of change depending on the product, depending on the manufacturing processes and stuff involved. But you're totally right, to where getting user feedback before, like for Monkey Feet, you can 100% use rapid prototyping, 3D printed stuff. There are a couple of good, three quick resources I'll drop. One is Protolabs, which is basically what you're talking about for FedEx Kinko's. They're great online. You can drop in your CAD model. You can say how many you want, what materials, all that stuff. Xometry also does it. That's X-O-M, Xometry. And then another one that's less for plastic parts and more for, like, let's say you want a metal piece cut out, laser cut, bent, stuff like that. There's a company called Send Cut Send, and they're great even for just like hobby projects and stuff. But all those are just a few resources. But when you, my recommendation would be to get as many people using, and the hard part is the unbiased part. It's really, really tough because we're, you know, when you have no one that, when you don't have a, like a business behind you, you're like, oh, who am I going to ask to try my product? It's like, oh, I can ask my mom and my aunt and my friend and all that stuff. But the real best way to do it is 3D print, like one of our monkey feet, right? Before, and this is what we did, 3D print all the pieces, put it together as much as you can, one off by hand, take it to your local gym and just sit there and have people try it and have people, you know, see what they think and see where their pain points are. Because what is interesting is we did that a bit, but when we had our first, we kind of placed a big bet on it, and we ordered 10,000 of them. And this is where we had a, yeah, it's pretty crazy. We had a, he is now like our third silent partner, but his, we were actually asking him for advice. This is another one of those, you want money, ask for advice. You want advice, ask for money. And so we were asking, we really were asking for advice. He had a big operation. He had warehousing space, all that. He ended up hooking us up with our manufacturer, and he had all of his warehousing. He did all the fulfillment for like the first 6 months-ish. And we were trying to go through that whole process of testing it. But at one point we were like, okay, we're just going to order this first container and then kick it off. Once we started selling them, we had these like three things that kept coming up over and over. And it was just like the three simple fixes. And like the easiest one was like just the foam pad in the back was hurting people's like Achilles area. So because it wasn't very ergonomic at the beginning, it was like very flat. So we like changed that. But that's one of those things that if we just did more initial user testing, we would have gotten sense into that.
I think, you know, you kind of made this sound as a negative, but I think it's actually a positive. So our first customers at Better Legal were, we basically put out a Facebook post. Well, before that, we just sold to a lawyer's client base. Like, that's a different story. But when we officially launched, it was just like a Facebook post, and we got 3 or 5 sales over the period of the month. And we used that feedback from people that we knew that were friends of ours that will tell us that it sucks. You know, you want the close people to tell you that will, you know, you're past being polite, right? It's like, I want to know what's wrong with this thing so you can make it better. Right. And so I think absolutely tapping your network, your Facebook friends, your Instagram friends, your TikTok friends, whatever. And I think a lot of people kind of like to see how the sausage is made. And tons of businesses on TikTok have blown up just by showing the behind the scenes stuff. And then people are interested in watching. There was that show a long time ago, it was like How It's Made.
Oh, I love that show.
Channel, and it's just like, you're like a zombie for 30 minutes watching about how like shoes are made or belts or like, you know, like Zodiac inflatable boats. And so I think people are into that. And I think it's an easy way to get those first 10 customers. And I have a theory, and I kind of have a mantra that may or may not be true, but I like to say it, that, you know, if you can get one customer, you can get 10. If you get 10, you get 100. If you get 100, you get 1,000. And if you can get 1,000 customers, you have a real business, right? At whatever price point you're selling at. So, do you mind, can I, after the show, can I get you to kind of just send me some of these like resources, links to stuff, and maybe just like what they are so I can add them to the show notes for people that might be interested in manufacturing stuff that didn't know how, can just be like, oh, here's, I can get this thing printed for $20 or whatever.
Yeah, of course.
That would be really, really cool. Okay. So now we're moving to Fiker Automotive and Alta Motors. So Fiker Automotive for one summer, Alta Motors for 3 years. Can you kind of combine those into one kind of narrative for me?
Yeah, of course. And that was actually a typo on my part. My bad. It's Fisker, and they're now called Karma. Honestly, that one was a one summer first internship at an auto company. I thought it was interesting.
This is Fisker, the electric car that Marquez Brownlee just reviewed, and they're like all freaking out right now.
Yeah, yeah, it's that one.
Wow.
It was that one about 10 years ago when they, went under and then back and under and back.
For 10 years and they just released the car now?
They had one back then. It's a different car. Go down the rabbit hole of Fisker. It's pretty wild. Okay. They've gone through different Chinese ownerships and it's pretty crazy. But I was, again, working at a car company. I was like, this is what I've wanted to do since I was young. You know, I love customizing stuff. And the one main takeaway was like, whoa, this company is way too big. I had to dress business casual, which I hated. And it was just a lot of bureaucracy and it dulled down creativity a ton. And so that was another one of those pieces where I was like, ooh, not sure this is for me. Fast forward out of college, I got, again, probably this is what I call the coolest job ever, to where it was, you know, for those dirt bike motorcycle enthusiasts out there, there's all the dirt bike companies are in either Japan or Austria. And so there happened to be a dirt bike startup, electric dirt bike startup in basically where I wanted to move, San Francisco area. And I got a job there and I was like, I'll take anything. And I got an intern. I was actually an intern for like a year. This is after college too. But I loved it. You know, it was the coolest people. It was smaller. It was like around 40 people when I started. So it felt small and I had hands on, I could kind of do all kinds of stuff. And all the way from just like, you know, doing all of the, I don't know if we could say bitch work on this, but all the way from like the bitch work bottom tier testing little things, starting to design parts, all the way until about 3 years later, where I was like lead designer for suspension and chassis, doing a lot of heavy design work. And we actually started partnering with Harley Davidson at the end, co-designing their next electric bike, which they actually just released. And it got a little weird at the end, and with the two companies, and Alta ended up going under, which was a bummer. But that was kind of the coolest job I think I'd ever had, to where I was working on dirt bikes all day. I was also an avid dirt bike rider, so I was testing the bikes all the time. I remember at one point we had to test this one bug that was happening when you'd hit the ground, and so I was jumping off the loading dock like 500 times in a day, like over and over on the bikes. And so it was crazy. And the one takeaway from this for me is I remember sitting there with my buddy who also started a different company, but next to him, to where we're sitting there, we have these awesome jobs at a dirt bike tech company, blah, blah, blah. And we were bored out of our minds. And we were sitting there like, dude, we gotta start our own thing. Like this is, if this job is that perfect and we're still bored, we need to start our own thing. So that's when that's just what I call the entrepreneurial sickness. It's like, if you have the sickness and you realize it, then that's when you got to start something. So tying it back a bit, that's when I started going a little harder on Stoked. And then my friend's uncle called, who was my now co-founder's, my co-founder's uncle called, and he was like, hey, my nephew, he tore his ACL and he was trying to rehab his foot, and he was at the gym and it was packed, and you know, he just wanted to lift the dumbbells with his feet, and so he's trying to think about design something around it. I told him about you, and I was like, oh cool, I'd love to talk to him. And that is now my co-founder. And so we started working on this for about 2 years on the side. I ended up getting another job at a company called Boosted Boards, which is electric skateboards. I just worked for like electric toy companies for a while.
Adult electric toys.
Yeah, exactly. And then worked at that. Another awesome job, like super cool, great people, great culture at both of them, making cool widgets. And then, fast forward a bit, they went under as well. And they went under
I didn't know Boosted Boards went under.
Yeah. Yeah, they went under. They kind of were trying to go a little too big. They had crazy VC money that they had to do something about. And
this is something I got to talk about, just because you know, in early 2024, you know, in 2021, I felt like such a loser, because everybody was getting gobs and gobs of money. My company was not, we were just not raising, we raised a little bit of money. But we had a competitor that started about the same time as us. So we're Better Legal and they were Zen Business. They were actually doing something else. And my co-founder did their legal documents, and they were originally called Corp Tech or something like that. And they were selling to lawyers. We started selling direct to consumers. They pivoted to what we're doing. They hired they somehow got the CTO of Homeway to be their CEO. And then they kind of pivoted towards what we're doing, but they raised gobs and gobs and gobs of money. I think they've raised a total of $270 million. And now they're like worth $1.7 billion on the last raise. But there's so many companies that raised so much money in 2021 that now are just like firing people, going out of business. And it's like, how did you light $10 million, $50 million, $100 million on fire? And this goes further into why I think personally that we need to do less VC. There needs to be like VCs need to be for like unlocking a problem that needs to be solved before you can unlock a market. Or there's a business that is clearly working and they're just strapped for cash and they just need that cash to like pour gasoline on the fire that's already thriving. And so like boosted boards should totally exist right now. Like I know a lot of people that had them around Austin and they loved them. And so like, why isn't that a company that exists? Because they raised too much money. They tried to grow too big. They thought the market was bigger than it should have been. And so they scaled up a company that was too big, and then they fell on their face. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I totally agree. And VC and PE money, like I think they have their place, but I think it's much less of a place in the current market kind of reflects to where it's like,
you just don't need as much money to start a business now.
No,
no matter like what it is.
Some things take moonshots, right? It's like Rivian's like a good example too. It's like, if you want to make Rivian, like you need a lot of money and a lot of development years behind the scenes and stuff to make that work. But like most things aren't Rivian, even Boosted wasn't, they were Kickstarters, and you know, they ended up bringing on VC later. And that is, you know, when you bring on VC, you got to answer to VCs. Like if you are not increasing top line and bottom line every year, then you're failing and stuff's going to change. So it's a bit of a dance with the devil.
Okay. So Boosted failed, and at roughly, I guess at the same time as when, Monkey Feet was taking off, like what was the timing there? And, you know, you said you were kind of doing it on the side for 2 years. And I think that's another thing that people need to understand is that businesses are not like, I'm starting this and now we're going. A lot of successful businesses kind of start as side projects that just take a little bit more of your time, And then you're selling more. And then you're like, well, then you've got that. Do I continue with my full-time job or do I do this other thing? And you've got to make that choice. What was that like for you?
Yeah, I think that's so important for people to hear, because I always tell people, just do it as a side hustle. What can you start right now? Like what piece of it can you do right now to start whatever business you're thinking about? And that'll just kind of get you into it. You don't need to have that clean cut. And that's what we did. I worked on it for about a year and a half in Boosted. I kind of saw the writing on the wall a little bit and I was like, all right, if Boosted goes under, I'm going full in on this instead of making an actual decision for myself. And so Boosted ended up going under, like COVID was the nail in the coffin. So COVID hits, Boosted goes under. I'm like, okay, I'm going all in. I went all in for like 6 months and then we launched the product. So there was about 6 months where I was working on this full time, no money. I was just like, I'm going to drain my savings and give it a chance, a try. And then we launched in October of 2020. And then from there, it was, you know, it was kind of the rocket ship started.
So what, let's say it didn't work. What would you have done? You know, depleted savings, you worked on this, it failed. Like, did you have a high confidence level that it was going to work? Like what made you make that decision? Or were you just like, YOLO, whatever?
I am a bit too analytical to go full YOLO, but my pro com was like, if it works, this is going to be life changing. And it is kind of what it ended up being. And if it doesn't work, what's the worst case scenario? And I didn't have that much money in savings. I had like 30 grand or something, 20 grand. And I was like, I'm just going to not have 20 grand. And then I'm going to go get another job and go back to write what I was doing at like Boosted and Alta. And I'm sure I'll find a great job and everything will be fine. And it's worth taking that risk for. It's kind of like a nothing ventured, nothing gained type of situation. And
but I think it also adds to your resume. You know, it's something where you get to say, I had this idea and I did, you know, because so often in interviews, they ask you like, oh, what did you do? What did you learn? And when you actually start a business, you get to look at everything. And, you know, in my modern day, I feel like I could walk into any business and walk into any department or division of any business and be at least mediocre.
Yeah. And have something to say.
and at least pipe up at a meeting with something moderately intelligent. But it gives you that ability to kind of be able to understand how the entire business works from soup to nuts. And then you realize where your shortcomings are or where too much time is being taken that isn't your secret sauce. Like you said, customer experience, bookkeeping, ads, these are things that are not crucial to the business for your business. And so those are the things you outsource first, get back your time to do more work. And it's almost like you're constantly in this process of like replacing yourself. Like you are constantly trying to, where people at corporations are trying to keep their jobs. As an entrepreneur and a business owner, you're trying to get rid of your job. You're trying to like automate yourself or like hire your roles away from yourself so you can focus on, you know, many more things. So it's like, oh, I got this thing out of my way. So now I can focus on these three or five other things that I wanted to, and I just never had the time.
Yeah. I love that. That's a great one. And I heard it was just a conference last week, and someone said the bottleneck is usually always at the top of the bottle. And it's one of those things where it's like, as you start growing, and these are kind of like larger company problems, but as you start growing, it's usually you at the top making the decisions that's, you know, inhibiting your growth. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, the more you can put people in place and the stuff that you're doing and free yourself up, the bigger the thing gets. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just listening to an Acquired episode about Hermes, and that was a bottleneck that they had, I think, in the 80s, where it was like the people at the top were inhibiting growth because they just could not remove themselves from these roles, and they finally did, and then they exploded like, you know, 5 or 10x or something like that. But anyway, thank you so much for the amazing narrative and stories. I think we covered a lot of really awesome stuff. We will have some resources in the show notes for anybody looking to, you know, manufacture any real physical products. Where can people find you online? You know, do you have socials you want to promote or anything like that?
Yeah, first of all, thanks so much, Chad. This was super fun. I had a good time. Probably LinkedIn, Paul Jackson. There's probably a million of those. Probably got to figure out which one.
Looks like this.
Yes, exactly. But check out our products. I think that's the biggest one. So animalhousefitness.com and at animalhousefit on Instagram is probably our biggest one. And if you want to follow me, it's more mountain biking stuff, but that's at Dirt Jackson on Instagram. So see you in there.
All right. Awesome.